I remember from home and I'll die in America.
Welcome to our group.
And this ought to show it right here.
Do you or someone you know suffer from depression? If so, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another Defenders Monday Night broadcast brought to you by our Colonel, your host, Kimberly Purvis. Now, before we get on with the show, I need to read our disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed on Defenders Radio 7 show and Facebook page are those of the callers and or authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Defenders 7. Now, for those of you new just tuning in to us, we are a humanitarian American patriot group, not a militia. By all means, join us if you like. We can be reached on our national Facebook page by typing in the search box, all capital letters, Defenders 7. Now, before you click on that join button, just know we expect all of our members and future members to participate through everything we do here in the Defender 7. If you get in and you feel you can't participate or don't want to be part, you may leave. No hard feelings. We're more than just a group. We consider ourselves one big extended family, and we treat each other as such. We're also on MeWe. Click on Organizations, scroll down, Defender 7, Humanitarian American Patriot Group. We also have a YouTube channel. Please hop over there, check it out. Do us a favor and click that subscribe button. We have a website. If you type in all lowercase letters, www.defenders, Roman numeral V as in Victor, with two small I's, .com. On our site, you will find that we have a store and a donate button. 100% of all proceeds from sales from our store and all donations we bring in go back to our communities throughout all 50 states in a time of need. So please, by all means, purchase something or hit that donate button. Help us to help you and our communities during a time of need. Now for tonight's show and all the shows we do here on Blog Talk Radio, we enjoy it when you call in and participate. And that number to call, area code 914-205-5773. Again, number to call to participate, area code 914-205-5773. Now, if you want to, we can keep you anonymous. No problem there. We just like the participation. If you feel uncomfortable with calling, We also do have a chat room here on Blog Talk that is live during our shows. Now, tonight's topic has been said. Hopefully, we don't lose anybody because it's been going on all day with all, not just Facebook and all the social media, but also internet. So far, so good with the radio station right now. But if we get cut off, you know why. I will now bring in your host, our Colonel Kimberly Purvis. Good evening, Kimberly.
Howdy, howdy. So, I found some information about the screw-up with the internet. It's global.
Okay. Yes.
Apparently, somebody changed some settings at Facebook, and they caused Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, WhatsApp, and a bunch of other social media, even TikTok. I mean, everybody. It was booted off the internet today. Now, some people did have access to it, but the problem is you couldn't comment, you couldn't post anything or anything like that. If you were lucky, you were able to load it. My internet and cable have been off all day, and it's just now, within the last hour or two, come back to hopefully work completely again. But some people were saying that's because also of that big leak of information that went out. And then with the court, you know what I'm talking about, with big tech and all the bullshit trouble they got into, they think that everything miraculously crashed the same exact day, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Hopefully everything is fixed. The last time that this happened was not global, but it was in June of this year. Remember when it was all of the internet actually got shut down, but it was less than an hour. So.
Right.
So this was like 5 or 6 hours that it was all jacked up. Excuse me. So, but I figured we'd continue on with more history of different empires and whatnot, I hope. We'll be able to keep it up.
Right.
So, because what happens is my internet, it'll load and then it'll do a timeout that it took too long. So, and it wasn't just those. It was all apps on my phone went stupid today.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, it wasn't just you. We were having the same problem.
Oh, so was Tennessee.
So was Wisconsin.
Oh, Wisconsin. Oh, okay. 1.5 billion Facebook users had all of their information. It got out. So I don't know if it was like a mass hack. They said they weren't hacked, but I call bullshit. I say somebody did this on purpose. So, but anyway.
No doubt. You know they did it on purpose.
Well, they said the next thing that's going to happen is a cyber attack.
Yep. And this is just the beginning.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I'm going to go ahead and start off with the Britannic Empire. And the country is the United Kingdom. And the capital was Londinium. That's what it used to be called, is Londinium, instead of London. Kind of an odd name. Londinium is also known as Roman London and was the capital of the Roman Britain during most of the period of the Roman rule. And it was originally a settlement established on the current site of the city of London around 47 to 50 A.D. And it sat at the key crossing point over the River Thames, which right now where the River Thames is at, you know, they have a thing and all that cool shit. But the weird thing is, hold on a second. Come on. So their rule for this one particular empire was only for 10 years. Woo. So it was a breakaway state of the Roman Empire. So I'm going to go look it up. So the Carusian Revolt was from 286 to 296 A.D., was an episode in the Roman history when a Roman naval commander, Carusius, declared himself emperor over Britain and northern Gaul. His Gallic territories were retaken by the Western Caesar, Constantius Chlorus, in 293. After when this print is so freaking small. Carusius was assassinated by his subordinate, Electus. Subordinate, you know, assassinates you. Britain was regained by Constantius and his subordinate, Asclepiodus, in 296. So, Carusius, a Menippean of humble birth, rose to the ranks of the Roman military and was appointed to a naval command at Bononia, tasked with clearing the English Channel of Frankish and Saxon raiders. However, he was accused of collaborating with Enrich himself and the Western Augustus. Maximian ordered him to be put to death. So he responded by declaring himself Emperor of Britain, and his forces comprised not only his fleet, augmented by the new ships he had built, and the three legions stationed in Britain, but a legion that he had seized in Gaul, a number of Roman auxiliary units, and a levy of Gaulish merchant ships and barbarian mercenaries attracted by the prospective booty. A panegyric delivered to Maximinium in AD 288 or 289 refers to the emperor preparing an invasion to cast out Carusius. Later, panegyric I don't know where these people come up with these funky names. To Constantius Chlorus said the invasion failed due to bad weather, although Carusius claimed it as a military victory. And Eutropius says that the hostilities were in vain thanks to Carusius' military skill, and peace was agreed. And then there was the rise of the Britannic Empire. So this revolt led to a short-lived Britannic Empire, like I said, from 286 to 296. And Carusius was a Menippean naval commander of the Britannic fleet. And then he revolted upon learning the death sentence of a death sentence ordered by the emperor Maximian on charges of having abetted Frankish and Saxon pirates and having embezzled recovered treasure. So he consolidated control over all the provinces of Britain and some of the northern Gaul while Maximian dealt with other uprisings. An invasion that was in 288 failed to unseat him, and an uneasy peace ensued with Carathias, ensuing coins and inviting official recognition. In 293, the junior emperor Constantius, besieging the rebel port of Bolung-sur-Mer, by land and sea. And after it fell, Constantius attacked Carathias's other Gallic holdings in Frankish allies, and Carathias was usurped by his treasurer, Alexius Julius Asclepiodus. Don't you love the people with three first names? Landed an invasion fleet near Southampton and defeated Alexius in a land battle. So the Roman Empire was recovered. And then it went into a medieval British legend. Carathias, Alexius, Asclepiodus, and Constantius appear in the Geoffrey of Monmouth's Historia Regum Britannica, like the Encyclopedia Britannica, basically, before the actual encyclopedia set got launched. But that's where they appear, all of them. And so 10 years after Asclepiodus, that's what his name is, Asclepiodus, is deposed by Coel, Duke of Gloucester, for his part in the persecution of Christians under Diocletian. The Romans and Constantius negotiate with him. Coel agrees to pay tribute to Rome and gives Constantius' daughter Helena in marriage, and upon his death, Constantius becomes the new king of Britain. Ta-da! Yeah, it's short-lived. Shortest one we're probably going to do is 10 years. So we continue on with the actual British Empire, and which is also the UK, and then the capital city is London. They changed the name of it to London. So it started in 1603, and they say right now it says either surviving until present or ended in 1997. So roughly 394-year reign. And it started with James I and ended with Elizabeth II. And the largest empire in world history, precursor to the modern Commonwealth of Nations, remnants of the empire included British overseas territories and crown dependencies. Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II remains as sovereign. For many, the handover of Hong Kong to the People's Republic of China on July 1st, 1997, marked the end of the British Empire. And think of it, today, the British Empire still rules over a lot of places. I'm not sure if they still reign over Ireland, or I know they lost Northern Ireland. The British West Indies, a lot, parts of Africa and India and the Cayman Islands and things like that. So they kind of like, they went around, and I guess that's how their empire got to be so big. So the British Empire was composed of the dominions, colonies, protectorates, mandates, and other territories ruled or administered by the United Kingdom and its predecessor state, and it began with overseas possessions and trading posts established by England between the late 16th and early 18th centuries. Oh, also, the British, where is Krakatoa, the volcano? You guys know, by any chance?
I'm not sure.
I know before, right, you know, when Krakatoa did its little big spew, the British Empire did rule over. Let me look at it, because I saw, the only reason why I know that I say this is because I saw a documentary about it. And what they did was they did a reenactment of it, and they did it based on documents. When did Krakatoa erupt? Okay. In 1883. So it's in Indonesia. And so the British Empire ruled Indonesia. And they used to, all their people, and they didn't, they weren't really slaves per se, but they, one of those things, whatever. But yeah, they also ruled over them. I went on a side note. The volcano, Cumbre Vieja, in La Palma Island, that damn thing's still erupting. It started September 19th, and it's still erupting right now. It's quite ugly. And the lava's already reached the ocean. And they said because of when the lava hits, there's volcanic glass. And all those toxins from the lava, and that's going to be going up in the air. And they said the lava is over 10 foot thick in some places. And so what's going to happen is once it hit that cliff, it's just going to keep building up. And their biggest fear, once that shit hardens, and if there's another earthquake, it will crack that off and fall into the ocean. And that's when they're expecting a tsunami. And it'll be so massive, it'll hit the East Coast. So, hopefully you guys are far enough inland. But I hope nothing happens. I hope nothing isn't doing anything stupid. So anyway, at its height, it was the largest empire in history. And for over a century, it was the foremost global power. By 1913, the British Empire held sway over 412 million people, 23% of the world population at the time. That's all there was in the world? It was 412 million people? Wow. And by 1920, it covered 13.7 million square miles, which is 24% of the Earth's total land area. As a result, its constitutional, legal, linguistic, and cultural legacy is widespread. At the peak of its power, it was described as the empire on which the sun never sets, as the sun is always shining on at least one of its territories. So during the Age of Discovery and the 15th and 16th centuries, Portugal and Spain had pioneered European exploration of the globe, and in the process established large overseas empires. Envious of the great wealth these empires generated, England, France, and the Netherlands began to establish colonies and trade networks of their own in the Americas and Asia. And a series of wars in the 17th and 18th centuries with the Netherlands, France, left England the dominant colonial power in North America. So Britain became the dominant power in the Indian subcontinent after the East India Company's conquest of the Mughal Bengal and the Battle of Plassey in 1757. And, you know, honestly, I think after America got its freedom from England and more countries have decided, you know, we've had enough of this crap. We want to be our own. And that's what happened pretty much. The American War of Independence resulted in British losing some of its oldest and most populous colonies in North America by 1783. British attention had then turned towards Asia, Africa, and the Pacific. After the defeat of France and the Neopolitan Wars Britain emerged as the principal naval and imperial power of the 19th century and expanded its imperial holdings. So the period of relative peace from 1815 to 1914, that's when the British Empire became the global hegemon and was later described as Pax Britannica, which means British peace. Alongside the formal control that Britain exerted over its colonies, its dominance of how much world trade meant that it effectively controlled the economies of many regions, such as Asia and Latin America. Increasing degrees of autonomy were granted to its white settler colonies, some of which were reclassified as dominions. So by the start of the 20th century, Germany and the United States had begun to challenge Britain's economic lead. Military and economic tensions between Britain and Germany were major causes of the First World War, during which Britain relied heavily on its empire. The conflict had put such enormous strains on its military, financial, and manpower resources. Although the empire achieved its largest territorial extent immediately after World War I. So Britain was no longer the world's preeminent industrial or military power. Second World War, Britain's colonies in East Asia and the Southeast Asia were corrupted by the Empire of Japan. So despite the final victory of Britain and its allies, the damage to the British prestige helped accelerate the decline of the empire. So India, Britain's most valuable and populous possession, achieved independence as part of a larger decolonization movement in which Britain granted independence to most territories of the empire. The Suez Crisis confirmed Britain's decline as a global power, and the transfer of Hong Kong to China in 1997 marked for the many the end of the British Empire. So 14 overseas territories remain under British sovereignty. After independence, many former British colonies joined the Commonwealth of Nations, a free association of independent states. 16 of those, including the United Kingdom, retain a common monarch, and that's Queen Elizabeth. I mean, yes, she has the real power. The Parliament has it. So I guess all of the dukes, the duchesses, and all that crap, it's mainly for show. But they still play a part, you know, in their little facade going around. So the foundations of the British Empire were laid when England and Scotland were separate kingdoms in 1496, when King Henry VII of England, following the successes of Spain and Portugal in overseas exploration, commissioned John Cabot to lead an expedition to discover a route to Asia via the North Atlantic. Cabot sailed in 1497, and 5 years after the first voyage of the Christopher Columbus and made landfall on the coast of Newfoundland, he believed that he reached Asia, and so there was no attempt to found the colony. Cabot led another voyage to the Americas the following year, but he didn't return from his voyage, and it's unknown what happened to his ships. Well, if the Bermuda Triangle was, you know, doing its thing back in the day, it's probably the reason why he never returned. Yada, yada, shmada. So no further attempts to establish English colonies in the Americas were made until well into the reign of Queen Elizabeth I during the last decades of the 16th century. So in the meantime, in 1533, Statute and Restraint of Appeals declared that this realm of England is an empire, and the Protestant Reformation turned England and Catholic Spain into implicable enemies. So in 1562, Elizabeth I encouraged the privateers John Hawkins and Francis Drake to engage in slave raiding attacks against the Spanish and Portuguese ships off the coast of West Africa with the aim of establishing the Atlantic slave trade. And this effort was rebuffed, and later, as the Anglo-Spanish Wars intensified, Elizabeth I gave her blessing to further privateering raids against Spanish ports in the Americas and shipping that was returning across the Atlantic, laden with treasure from the New World. So at the same time, influential writers such as Richard, Hakluyt, and John Dee, who was the first to use the term the British Empire, were beginning to press for the establishment of England's own empire. So by this time, Spain had become the dominant power in the Americas and was exploring the Pacific Ocean. Portugal had established trading posts and forts from the coast of Africa to Brazil, to China, and France. And they had begun to settle the St. Lawrence River area to become New France. So although England tended to trail behind Portugal, Spain, and France in establishing overseas colonies, it also established its first overseas colony in 16th century Ireland by settling it with products from England, drawing on precedents dating back to the Norman invasion of Ireland in 1169. So, then it goes into Americas, Africa, and the slave trade. The Caribbean initially provided England's most important and lucrative colonies, but not before several attempts at colonization had failed. In an attempt to establish a colony in Guyana in 1604, lasted only 2 years and failed in its main objective to find gold deposits. Colonies in St. Lucia in Grenada and Barbados and Nevis. The colonies soon adopted a system of sugar plantations, successfully used by the Portuguese in Brazil, which depended on slave labor, and at first Dutch ships to sell the slaves and buy the sugar to ensure the increasingly healthy profits of this trade remained in English hands. So Parliament decreed in 1651, that only English ships would be able to... Sorry. This little asshole, sorry guys, did this to me until 5 o'clock this morning. I'm going to dope his ass with Benadryl tonight. Hopefully he'll sleep. So, yeah, I'm lost. let's see. So Parliament decreed, only English ships would be able to ply their trade in English colonies. So this led to the hostilities with the United Dutch Provinces and a series of Anglo-Dutch wars, which would eventually strengthen England's position in the Americas at the expense of the Dutch. In 1655, England annexed the island of Jamaica from the Spanish, and then in 1666, succeeded colonizing the Bahamas. England's first permanent settlement in the Americas was founded in 1607 in Jamestown, led by Captain John Smith and managed by the Virginia Company. Bermuda was settled and claimed by England as a result of the 1609 shipwreck of Virginia Company's flagship. So in 1615 was turned over to the newly formed Somers Isle Company. The Virginia Company's charter was revoked in 1624, and direct control of Virginia was assumed by the Crown, so thereby founding the colony of Virginia. The London and Bristol Company was created in 1610 with the aim of creating a permanent settlement on Newfoundland, but was largely unsuccessful. 1620, Plymouth was founded as a haven for Puritan religious separatists known as Pilgrims. So fleeing from religious persecutions would become the motive of many English would-be colonists to risk the arduous transatlantic voyage. Maryland was founded as a haven for Roman Catholics in 1634. Rhode Island in 1636 was a colony of tolerant of all religions, and Connecticut for all the Congregationalists, my bad. And the province of Carolina was founded in 1663 with the surrender of Fort Amsterdam in 1684. So England gained control of the Dutch colony of the New Netherlands, renaming it New York. Ha! Huh. See, I didn't know any of this stuff. Formalized in negotiations following the Second Anglo-Dutch War in exchange for Suriname. In 1681, the colony of Pennsylvania was founded by William Penn, and the American colonies were less financially successful than those of the Caribbean, but had large areas of good agricultural land and attracted far large numbers of English immigrants who preferred the temperate climate. So in 1670, Charles II incorporated the Royal Charter, the Hudson Bay Company, granting it a monopoly on the fur trade in the area known as Rupert's Land, which would later form a large portion of the Dominion of Canada. Fortune trading posts established by the HBC were frequently the subject of attacks by the French, who had established their own fur trading company in adjacent New France. 2 years later, the Royal African Company was inaugurated, receiving from King Charles a monopoly of the trade to supply slaves to the British colonies of the Caribbean. From the outset, slavery was on the basis of the empire in the West Indies. Until abolition of its slave trade in 1807, Britain transported a third of all slave ships across the Atlantic. Hold on. 3.5 million Africans. To facilitate this trade, forts were established on the coast of West Africa, such as James Island, Accra, and Bunce Island, and the British Caribbean. The percentage of the population of African descent rose from 25% in 1650 to around 80% in 1780. In colonies, from 10% to 40%. Over all the same time period. For slave traders, the trade was extremely profitable and became a major economic mainstay for such Western British cities, such as Bristol, Glasgow, and Liverpool, which formed the third corner of the triangular trade with Africa and the Americas. So for the transported harsh and unhygienic conditions on the slaving ships and poor diet, meant the average mortality rate during the middle passage was 1 in 7. When a lot of, you'll notice that if you do your family history, when people left Scotland and Ireland, England, to come here, a lot of people died, like I said. They died on the ship on the way over, and some of them never even made it. I know that I lost some of my probably 10th, 12th great-grandfather back. I know he was only 35 when he had died, or roughly. He was in his 30s, I believe. So it didn't matter the age. It was quite the horrific journey back then. So, in 1695, the Parliament of Scotland granted a charter to establish a settlement in 1698 in the Isthmus of Panama, besieged by neighboring Spanish colonists of New Granada. And afflicted by malaria, the colony was abandoned 2 years later. The Darien scheme was a financial disaster for Scotland. A quarter of Scottish capital was lost in the enterprise. It ended the Scottish hopes of establishing its own overseas empire. The episode had major political consequences, helping to persuade the government of Scotland in the merits of turning the personal union with England into a political and economic one. I don't know if you guys knew this. I know I'm pretty sure everyone's heard of Robert the Bruce and William Wallace and all of those guys in Scotland. Is it just me and you, Bobby, or is anybody else on here?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. I'm sure you guys all heard of Robert the Bruce, right? There's a movie, another movie, and it ties into Braveheart. It's called Robert the Bruce, but it takes place like 7 years after. And so the way Braveheart ended, you think, oh, great, that's when Scotland won its freedom. No. It took Scotland 30 years to win their freedom from the English. Yep. And the same guy that was Robert the Bruce in Braveheart was the same guy who did Robert the Bruce in the movie Robert the Bruce. And it's almost 3 hours long. But let me tell you something. It's amazing at what they went through. And everybody said when William Wallace died, that was it. There was never getting their freedom because he had such passion to get their freedom that he died for it. Yeah. And so they didn't believe there were seven battles.
Would follow through. That's what it was. They didn't have faith in Robert. They did not have faith in Robert the Bruce. They didn't think that he would follow through.
No. And so, but you got to watch the movie. It's a great movie. It's on Hulu. It's called Robert the Bruce. And it just came out. I don't know how old it is. Only a year or two, maybe. I don't know. But it shows what they went through. And yeah, so it took 30 years for them to get their freedom from the English. And the funny thing is we thought our short-lived battle with England to get our freedom was bloody and brutal. They went 30 years of that.
It was bad.
And the thing is, look, we've been in the Middle East for 20 years, but it wasn't for our freedom. It was for whatever. But still, in 20 years, we didn't lose as many people as Scotland did. And the thing is, in Scotland, when a boy turns 11 years old, they go join the military. And they join the fight for freedom for Scotland. And so
the thing is that the difference, like with Afghanistan, it wasn't our war. It's not our land. You know, I mean, with Scotland or here in America, you know, those revolutions, we're fighting for ourselves. In Afghanistan, it's a totally different issue, or even Vietnam or Korea.
Oh, yeah.
You're fighting for the people themselves, you know, it's kind of hard. Afghanistan really can't be compared to Vietnam or Korea.
And see, that's just it. It's like we can't even compare the amount of years for freedom. Right. It's like, wow. Yeah. You know.
The Scottish who came here, there were Scottish, of course, that came to America and settled, you know, up in the Appalachians. That's where they get the hillbillies and the rednecks. Is because of the Scottish who settled there. But yes, they're very, very, Robert the Bruce, it's a good movie. I've seen it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was like, I was like, no, this shit didn't happen. And I looked it up.
Yeah, I was surprised. It was fairly accurate.
It was very accurate because I looked it up. And one thing, and I did not believe the movie, Robert the Bruce did not have a castle.
No.
Even though he was the king of Scotland, he did not have a castle. Because he felt it was more important for himself to be with the people. So he slept in the homes of the Scottish people. And
right.
The thing is, Stirling Castle was never that big. It was a fort. And I'm like, wait a minute, I've been to Stirling Castle. What the hell? Yeah, when I spent that month and a half in Scotland, I'm like, I don't know what he's... And then I looked it up, and Stirling Castle was a fort. And it had been destroyed 3 times. As a matter of fact, Robert the Bruce is the one who destroyed the walls to keep the English from taking it over again. And so eventually they made it to the size it is. And it's massive. That castle is massive. And so it was until later on, until after, of course, he was dead. And the other kings and people were born there. They died there and blah, blah, blah. But and the Battle of Bannockburn is what won their freedom from the English. And I've been to the Battle of Bannockburn, and it's I think it's like 15 miles from Stirling. Well, it's all Stirling, but it's like the city. Honest to God, it's more like a town. And then the outskirts is what would be more like your county. And yeah, it's pretty cool. The Battle of Bannockburn, you go there, they have a 3D reenactment where you actually get to act it out, and it shows you in that 3D, kind of like watching your video games on TV now on the PlayStation and shit like that. It looks like that when you reenact it, but it's you. And or if there's not enough people to do the tour, they get you down and you've got this big huge table, and it lights up. It's got the underneath. It's got the lights, and it shows how they actually won the Battle of Bannockburn, because they tried to flood. The British tried to flood all their troops across this one little path, because the rest of it was swamp. It was just crap, and it was pretty cool. But now today, it's not. It's not, you know, bad. It's all flat now, and but yeah, it was pretty cool. So, anywho, when it goes in here, it shows the British territories in the Americas in 1763 to 1776, and it's got four. And the way the map looks, it doesn't have the state. It has all of the East Coast, and it's got Florida and Georgia, and Tennessee's not Tennessee on here, but and then it's got most of Canada, except Alaska, you know, the west side. But it shows all of that of which they lost. The war to the south influenced British policy in Canada, where 40 and 100,000 defeated loyalists had migrated from the new United States following independence. 14,000 loyalists who went to St. John and St. Croix River Valleys in part of Nova Scotia felt it far removed from the provincial government in Halifax. So London split off New Brunswick in a separate colony. So if you notice why a lot of our cities have English and Scottish names, like Glasgow, Virginia, or West Virginia, West Virginia, they pronounce it Glasgow, but it's Glasgow. Well, Glasgow, yeah, something like that, which came from Scotland. So a lot of our cities and stuff have English, Scottish, and Irish settlement names. Let's see. So the second British Empire was from 1783 to 1815. So since 1718, transportation to the American colonies had been a penalty for various offenses in Britain, with approximately 1,000 convicts transported per year forced to find him an alternative location after the loss of the 13 colonies in 1783. So the British government turned to Australia. So the coast of Australia had been discovered by Europeans, for Europeans by the Dutch in 1606, but there was no attempt to colonize it. So in 1770, James Cook charted the eastern coast, who on a scientific voyage claimed the continent for Britain and named it New South Wales. In 1778, Joseph Banks, Cook's botanist on the voyage, presented evidence to the government on the suitability of the Botany Bay for the establishment of a penal settlement. And in 1787, the first shipment of convicts set sail, arriving in 1788. So that's also how a lot of people came to America. As a penal colony.
Yep.
You know, so, and that's how, and like I said this before, they emptied out their prisons and stuff. They got the opportunity. Start over, you change your name. And that's how they did it. That's why the changings of last names or complete, like you can go from John Smith to John Brown. So that's how they did it. And see, Cuba did the same thing. Castro would empty his prisons and get rid of them, so he didn't have to pay for them. And that's I guess that's one way of looking at it. So they don't want you to be their problem. Now you're somebody else's problem. So blah blah blah. So Britain continued to transport convicts to New South Wales until 1840, to Tasmania until 1853, and to Western Australia until 1868. And the Australian colonies became profitable exporters of wool and gold, mainly because of gold rushes in Victoria, making it its capital, Melbourne, for the time of the richest city in the world. So during his voyage, Cook visited New Zealand, known to Europeans due to the 1642 voyage of the Dutch explorer Abel Tasman, and claimed both the North and South Islands for the British Crown in 1769 and 1770, respectively. Initially, interaction between the indigenous Maori population and Europeans was limited to the trading of goods. European settlement increased through the early decades of the 19th century, with numerous trading stations established, especially in the north. So in 1839, the New Zealand Company announced plans to buy large tracts of land and establish colonies in New Zealand. On February 6, 1840, Captain William Hobson and around 40 Maori chiefs signed the Treaty of Waitangi. This treaty is considered to be New Zealand's founding document, but differing interpretations of the Maori and English versions of the text, having meant it continues to be a source of dispute. So, and then they had the abolition of slavery, and then Britain's imperial century was from 1815 to 1914, and it goes on. And then they had their rivalry with Russia. Who doesn't? And then it goes on further to talk about the Dutch East India Company has founded the Cape Colony on the southern tip of Africa in 1652. This is long. So, and then it goes into the First World War One. I'm drawing a blank here. Hold on. Involvement in the war. So, and it just goes on and on and on. And it goes to World War II, decolonization and decline from 1945 to 1997. Like I said, the last of the British was in 1997. So, but I will say that in parts of Africa, the British still, the same way we give money to Israel, the same way we give money to other countries, the British church, some of the British churches actually go to Africa. And have you noticed that all the nuns are nurses? Because they go to these small, to these countries, the Congo and Zimbabwe, Namibia, and all of those, they still go and help because they have piss poor healthcare in Africa. But and let me say, parts of Africa have really bad healthcare, so they still take care of their. I don't want to say colonies, but you know what they did have part of their empire. So I'm gonna slap the shit out of my dog. The British Raj, I think that's how you pronounce it, R-A-J is Raj, was the ruler of the British crown on the Indian subcontinent from 1858 to 1947. The rule is also called the Crown Rule of India or Direct Rule in India. The region under British control was commonly called India. In so Pakistan, Bangladesh, India, and Myanmar were their capitals at the time. So their reign started in there from 1858 to 1947, a big whopping 89 years. And it was governed by the crown and part of the British Empire. Queen Victoria was proclaimed Empress of India in 1876. So it started with Queen Victoria and ended with George VI. Some of these I'm just going to go down, like I said, and just read the blurbs. Because I said we'll be here for a month of Sundays if I did each and every one of these. I'm not covering every single thing on here, just, you know, the highlights. So the Bruneian Empire, its capital was Brunei, 1368 until 1888 for 520 years, roughly. And lasted until it became a British protectorate in 1888. Muhammad Shah of Brunei was the first ruler, and I kind of want to talk to you. Hashim Jalu Alam Ahmadin was the last ruler. The first Bulgarian Empire, its capital city was Bulgaria, preceded by there's Bliska, Preslav, Skopje, Ohrid, and that was from 680 to 1018, which is roughly 338 years, founded by Khan Khan Asparuka, under Tsar Simeon I, became the first powerful Slavic empire, falls to the Byzantine Empire under Emperor Basil II. Aspara of Bulgaria was the first, and Ivan Vladislav of Bulgaria was the last. If you notice, I'm skipping all the ones that I cannot pronounce all the words, and that's why I'm doing the blurbs. The Second Bulgarian Empire, Bulgaria was its capital. Veliko Turnov. Hold on a second. What the hell is that? Oops. Sorry. Oh, my bad. That was the Bulgaria is the modern state. The other one was the capital city. Now I got to find out where I was at. Get it bored. I'm telling you. But I'll find it eventually. Okay. So it started from 680 to 1018. Wrong one. So the Second Bulgarian Empire was from 1185 to 1422, roughly 237 years. Successor of the First Bulgarian Empire under the Tsars Kaloyan and Ivan Aethon II became the most powerful state in the Balkans. So Peter II of Bulgaria was the first, and Ivan Sratmir of Bulgaria was at the last. Okay. The Duke, is it Duchy? Of Burgundy. Hold on a second. I'm trying to... okay. Things aren't cooperating. Sorry, guys. So the Duchy of Burgundy, Ductus Burgundi, French, Duché de Bourgogne, which is Dutch, emerged in the 9th century as one of the successors of the ancient kingdom of the Burgundians, which after its first conquest, after its conquest in 532, had formed a constituent part of the Frankish Empire. Upon the 9th century partitions, the French remnants of the Burgundian kingdom were reduced to a ducal rank by King Robert II of France in 1004. Robert II's son and their heir, King Henry I of France, inherited the duchy or the duchy, whatever, but succeeded it to his younger brother Robert in 1032. Other partitions had to the imperial kingdom of the Burgundy Arles, including the County of Burgundy. So Robert became the ancestor of the ducal house of Burgundy, a cadet branch of the royal Capet dynasty, ruling over a territory that roughly conformed to the borders of the territories of the modern region of Burgundy. Upon the extinction of the Burgundian male line with the death of Duke Philip I in 1361, it reverted to King John II of France and the royal house of Valois. The Burgundian duchy was absorbed in a larger territorial complex after 1363 when King John II succeeded to his younger son, Philip. With his marriage to the Countess Margaret III of Flanders, he laid the foundation for a Burgundian state, which expanded further north into the Low Countries, collectively known as the Burgundian Netherlands. Upon further acquisitions of the County of Burgundy, Holland, and Luxembourg, the House of Valois Burgundy came into possession of numerous French and imperial fiefs, stretching from the Western Alps to the North Sea. So in some ways, reminiscent of the Middle Frankish realm of Lotharingia. The Burgundian state, in its own right, was one of the largest ducal territories that existed at the time of emergence of early modern Europe. So after over 100 years of Valois-Burgundy rule, however, the last duke, Charles the Bold, rushed the Burgundian wars and was killed in the 1477 Battle of Nancy. Battle of Nancy, why would you know, I'm not even going to ask where they came up with some of these names. The extinction of the dynasty led to the absorption of the duchy itself to the French crown lands by King Louis XI. While the bulk of the Burgundian possessions in the Low Countries passed to Charles's daughter Mary and her Habsburg descendants, and it's got a picture of the area of where it's at. So the Duchy of Burgundy was a successor of the earlier Kingdom of the Burgundians, which evolved out of territories ruled by the Burgundians and the East Germanic tribes that arrived in Gaul in the 5th century. So the Burgundians settled in the area around Dijon, Chalon-sur-Saône, Mâcon, Autun, and Châtillon-sur-Seine. Ha! Say that 5 times real fast. And gave its name to the region. The kingdoms of the Burgundians was annexed by the Merovingian king of the Franks, Childebert I, in 534, following their defeat by the Franks. So it was recreated However, on several occasions, when the Frankish territories were redivided between the sons, Kish King. Quite that special. So instead of the oldest one getting it or the next in line, they just divide it all up. So I guess that's one way of doing it. As part of the kingdom of the Franks, Burgundy maintained a semi-autonomous existence with the Burgundians maintaining their own law code. However, southern Burgundy was pillaged by the Saracen invasion of the 8th century. When Charles Martel drove the invaders out, he divided Burgundy into four commands: Arles Burgundy, Vienne Burgundy, Allemagnac Burgundy, and Frankish Burgundy. And he appointed his brother, Childebrand, governor of the Frankish Burgundy. So under the Carolinians, Burgundian separatism lessened, and Burgundy became a purely geographical term, referring only to the area of the counties of the former Burgundy. So it has the beneficiary dukes. By the time Richard the Justicar, the Duchy of Burgundy, was beginning to emerge, Richard was officially recognized by the king as a duke. So he also stood as an individual count in each county he held. As Duke of Burgundy, he was able to wield an increasing amount of power over his territory. The term that came to be applied to the collective body of dukes' territory was a ducatus. Included the Richard's ducatus, were the regions of Audenice. Yeah, sure, dude. I'm gonna skip all these names because I can't pronounce any of them. But there's a whole shitload of them. These territories were given law and order, protected from the Normans, and served as a haven for persecuted monks. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of French in here or Dutch that I just cannot read, and I'm not going to butcher it. So under Rudolf of France, the son of Richard, Burgundy was briefly catapulted to a position of prominence in France. Since he became king of France in 923, after ascending to the Burgundian territories in 921. So it was from his territories in Burgundy that he drew the resources needed to fight those who challenged his right to rule. Man. Oh, crap. I hate touch screen computers. So this goes on to discuss first succession crisis. Henry the Venerable died in 1002, leaving two potential heirs, his nephew Robert the Pious, King of France, and his stepson Otto William, Count of Burgundy, a vassal of the Holy Roman Empire, whom Henry had adopted and named their son, their heir, sometime before. So there's that issue, that first crisis. And then there was a second succession crisis. Even before Philip's death, France and Burgundy had begun considering the knotty problem of succession. By the terms of his will, the Duke had stated that he directed and appointed as heirs to his county and to our possessions, whether they may be those male and female, who by law or local custom ought or may inherit. So, okay. And then it goes into all the different dukes. John the Good and Valois Burgundy. And then it goes into all that cool stuff. So. Okay. Yeah. No. I'm getting warnings back on my internet. Sorry. So, oh I'm gonna see if I can pronounce any of this stuff in this, and the Buyid dynasty, or the Buyid, the Persians, also known as the yeah, see, I told you. It was the Shia Iranian dynasty of Daylamite origin, which mainly ruled over Iraq and central of southern Iran from 934 to 1062, coupled with the rise of other Iranian dynasties in the region. The approximate century of Buyid rule represents the period of Iranian history, sometimes called the Iranian Intermezzo, since after the Muslim conquest of Persia, it was an interlude between the rule of Abbasid Caliphate and the Seljuk Empire. Gonna have to take a break here for a second. If you want to, you know, discuss, my retards are outside barking and it's getting late. Sorry.
Gotta love history.
I know. God love my retards.
It's amazing how many things repeat, you know, you think you learn, and we do learn from them, but we still wind up repeating a lot of shit.
What do you mean? Like, oh, being at all the different shows with different information? Ow, crap.
I meant historically speaking. I mean,
oh, history will always repeat itself.
Right.
History.
Right.
Yeah. History is always going to repeat itself because, man, it's stupid.
And, I mean, yeah, we learn. I mean, it's not that we don't learn, but it's like,
oh, no.
We don't learn what we're supposed to learn.
Okay, here's the thing. I think we learn, we just don't care. And that's
right.
The problem. Man has learned, but they just don't care. It's like, I see the sign that says I'm going to fall off a cliff, but I don't care. I'm just going to keep on going forward. And you fall off the cliff, and you're like, damn, why did I fall off the cliff? I don't know, because maybe you didn't pay attention. That's the problem with mankind.
And I have to say you're right, but I also think that they learn and they think that they can do it differently. They think that they're
that's the definition of insanity.
Yep. you learn something. It's like, look at socialism. When you look throughout all of history, you know, the different types of governments and everything, and but they all keep repeating themselves, the same ones over and over again. You know, even when they, you know, yes, we, America, is a completely new thing, but that doesn't mean that there weren't other, that they didn't keep rehashing the old ones thinking they could do it differently.
No,
you
that's
know what
they
mean?
Want. They're like, oh, socialism's good. I can do it differently. No, socialism is socialism any way you look at it.
And we're not even doing socialism. It's Marxism, which is communism. You know, it's like they say, oh, well, we want to do socialism, but you're actually not. You're skipping over socialism. So, I was watching, you know, like socialism or even communism, I guess, could live in a very small community, like a commune, where everybody thinks the same. You know what I mean? They're all working together to help each other. But on a grand scale, it's just not going to work because man is just too greedy, I guess. I mean, power hungry, selfish. They may mean well, but it's like they think they know what everybody else needs.
Hold on a second. Okay.
I think we just learn how to kill better. That's what it is.
Okay. One way communism is different from socialism is it calls for the transfer of power to the working class by a revolutionary, then gradual means. Both communism and socialism advocate public control of the means of production, although socialism allows for the continued existence of capitalism in some parts of the economy.
Yep.
Okay, that just sounds ass backwards because
they both are good.
Cuba's communism. Okay, under communism and socialism, you don't own shit.
No. Nope.
The government has to provide for you. And I think that is, and see, what's wrong with this generation in America? They've never known anything but freedom. Everything's
right.
been handed to them on a silver platter. They have this sense of self-entitlement. Okay. And God forbid, and see, I think the global elitists knew this was going to happen and it was going to work. By coming up with this pandemic of COVID, this is why they believe socialism is good. We don't have to work for anything. The government will take care of us. The government's going to take everything you have and then tell you you can only own so much. But here's the thing.
The government doesn't have anything.
Do what?
The government doesn't have anything.
Oh,
how are they going to pay for all of it?
We
don't have anything.
But see, that's just it. We have enough food. We've already discussed this. We have enough food on the planet Earth to feed everybody.
No.
Greed is the number one problem. Now,
I agree.
It's going to work. And so here's the thing is they believe, well, why should we work? We have the government to pay us. Okay, I'll give you that. Okay, you want to be lazy and self-entitled, you go right ahead. Who's going to work to make all the shit that you get from the government?
They are. They don't realize.
Someone's
going to
do it.
They're fighting the slavery. They're fighting slavery, but they're actually going to turn themselves into slaves because the government, the work has to get done, and the government's going to come to you and say, you either do it or you don't eat. That's all.
Oh,
you
but they'll change their tune. They will change their tune when that comes around. You either
by then
do what the government.
Late.
Well, you know what? That's tough shit. I think anybody who wants socialism or communism in America, go find yourself a country that does that. Stay there for a year, and you tell me if you like it. And then guess what? Your passport revoked.
Go take it for a test ride.
Yeah. Take your shit and go. No, you don't come back. We're tired of the test. We did the test run. We're done. We are over the shit. I'm not doing it. And
but,
so.
Like I said, I love history. I mean, we look at history, you know, you've gone over. I mean, there's so much. We've done history. I don't know. I mean, we've been doing this for a year, 2 years or whatever. And we're always doing history, and we never talk about the same stuff because it's just
oh, no.
So much.
I mean, there's just so much. I just have to find all the empires. And that's what I decided, you know, we'll just keep doing this because it's, you know.
I wish that kids today were learning about this kind of stuff. A lot of this stuff that you're talking, I mean, I'm going to admit I didn't know, but some of it I vaguely remember learning. You know what I mean?
I didn't learn any of shit.
But
honestly,
you're younger than me, too. But, you know, and my mom, she was very big on education and learning and stuff.
Get me wrong. My area of learning was not history. It was music, home ec, and English. That was it. I hated English too until I had a really awesome teacher in the ninth grade, and he helped me enjoy it more. And then he was a young teacher, and so it's just the way he taught us.
I feel really bad for these young people today because they're really not learning anything, and it's not all their fault. And it's sad. And now you've got the education director, whatever that person is, you know, that Biden aside, saying that parents don't have the right to interfere in education. They should not be allowed, and that they should be listed as domestic terrorists because they're coming in and disturbing the school board. And they want to say that their children, they should be declared domestic terrorists. And I'm like, what the hell happened? You know, these kids are
too
not
too much power's gone to their head.
And they
too much power.
I mean, you know, we
honestly,
can't really blame them. They've been brainwashed. So, you know, we're all responsible. We voted for these people that are in office.
But
now we got to fix it.
Yeah, there's
it.
No fixing it. No, there's no fixing it. Just blow it up. Start from scratch. that's all there is to it. anywho. Oh, but yeah, there's no... The thing is with all this crap that's going on, I don't, in all honesty, the way all they care about is white rage and all this bullshit. And it's like, you guys are concentrating on the wrong thing. And like I saw this video. And this woman said this song, the Brooks and Dunn song, is filled with racism. And it talks about a guy sitting at a bar contemplating his life.
I'm not familiar
and
with
she
the
said,
song.
Huh?
I said, I don't think I'm familiar with the song.
Oh, you probably are. It talks about him being on the wrong side of town. He's referring to his life. Okay. And she said it's racism. And so this other chick, I mean, she's been on Fox and Newsmax because one of her videos went viral. And she was stating the facts here. If you look for racism everywhere you go, you're going to find it.
Oh, of course. That applies to anything.
So remember, okay, I know this is off subject, but it's still a history. You know the Bugs Bunny cartoon where it was him and the Indians, and he's singing one little engine, two little engine, three little engine, four, and he called him a half breed. He goes, oh, no, that's three and a half because he's a half breed. Okay. Someone said, oh, my God, it's so racist. He's talking about Indians. You know what? Back then, there was no butthurt feelings. And he goes, yeah, because you didn't want to see it. No, because we didn't care. Back in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't any because nobody gave a shit. It's only racist if you make it racist.
Yeah.
And,
I'm called
and
across the constantly, and I know how, and I actually know how to pronounce that N-word properly. you know what I mean?
Yeah. What's funny
is
all these kids that's under 28, I'm going to say under 30. Okay, I'm going to go with 30. Anyone who's under 30 wouldn't last a half an hour in the 70s or 80s. They'd be crying, looking for a safe place.
They'd be running home to mama.
And this is the reason why Gen X says, we have no feelings. Our souls are black as tar because we were latchkey kids. Because that's when both parents actually had a job. I babysat my brother when I was 13, and he was 12. And then I had a six-year-old brother. So my youngest brother, I'm 50. He's 43 now. So he's 7 years younger than me.
But different than they were when we, in the 70s and 80s.
This generation is soft. They're soft. They wouldn't laugh. That's why I laugh. And a lot of us, I know it's a joke. I know it's a joke, guys. a zombie apocalypse, an alien invasion, hell, a catastrophic event of Mother Nature, this whole generation would crack and die.
Yeah.
Because there's no internet. Oh, my God, they can't take selfies. We don't care. They would die.
Yeah.
And so it's sad. And people need – and people can talk shit about our generation, about Gen X, being mean and heartless and this, that, and the other. No, to survive, you had to be. Does it mean we're heartless? No, we're not. Only if you're stupid. And when I say stupid, I mean deliberate ignorance. Because if you're born with a low IQ, that's nothing you could do about that. That's totally separate. I'm talking if you're deliberately stupid because you feel like it, no, then you know what? You're fair game. So, which is why it's important to teach history and economics.
I love history.
I like it now. See, in all honesty, about a lot of this shit that I'm reading now, by me doing my family tree, no, we did not originate in America. My family started in Scotland, Ireland, and England, and then in Germany, and are the major. I mean, I do have Native American Indian in my family. So it's when my dad's father's side came to America, that's when, you know. But anyway, I learned a lot by doing my family history. And then because you have to do research along with going by, oh, shit, what the hell is that? You know what I'm talking about, Ancestry.com.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you gotta cross-reference a lot of shit because you can't just say, oh, yeah, that's my relative. So that's how I found out I'm related, well, way down the line, of Robert the Bruce. I'm like, there's no friggin' way.
Cool.
And I went back.
Well, no, like, I knew I'm related to Benjamin Rush. Side family thing, like his sister or something. Her family. And we have family, on my father's side, they've done it, and we actually have a map of what do we call it? I think some of the more recent ones did use Ancestry, like, to finish it off, but, I mean, they started doing this decades ago. When I was a teenager, we had the majority of it. Yeah.
I had my dad's side of the family almost completed. We are missing. I am missing multi generations because, once you hit the 1500s, there not a lot of records were kept unless you were royalty, a duke, duchess, and all that shit. So
right.
Yeah, I mean, that's.
And, My father's family, we can trace back, I think, to the 1400s because this Italian family, their daughter married into the French family, and they actually developed the process for making cognac that is still used today.
That's cool.
So, right, isn't it? I mean, and they have a suit of arms and all that stuff, and there's a castle and vineyards, and they're still working today. I mean, they still have some, their cognac is like four digits. You know, I think the cheapest bottle is three digits, like a couple of $100 for the cheapest bottle of cognac, and it's small. My point is like what you were saying is, I mean, This was a whole process. I mean, now, I haven't talked to any of the family members in a while, but, like, I know I'm the only one with my name in the United States. There, in fact, there's very few with our last name in the United States in general. but I'm the only one with my name. Now, there is another Maria, you know, in South America, but her middle name is different and her date of birth is different. So,
oh, I couldn't tell you how many of the same of my name, of Kimberly's there are, and it's a pain in the ass. Yeah. Under my maiden name and my second
really?
Married name. Good God, I'm telling you. Yeah.
But again, like it takes research and people that, you know, like some people do change their names, some don't. Ow! So how do you do that? Sorry, my cat bit me. So at any rate, so it was really kind of cool when you follow through. And, you know, my father's side, like I said, my grandmother is related to Rush, you know, and Benjamin Rush, I don't know if his family, I don't know that they came over on the Mayflower. I don't think they did not come over on the Mayflower. But they came over on one of the first ones after that or something, I think. I know that family's been around a long time. But, again, back to your point is that when you're doing all of this, it takes a lot of time, and it's not a quick process, even if you do use Ancestry.com. Now, with DNA and all this other stuff, you know, you can find out more. Oh, did you see that? I'm going off track here. DNA. Did you see that they, with those three Egyptians with the mummies?
Uh-uh.
Oh, but DNA. They took DNA from three Egyptian mummies and made facial renditions of them. And they look more like today's Europeans than Middle Eastern people.
Cool.
Google it. Yeah, Google it. So we're going to, Ancestry.com is going to be, and I highly recommend you don't do it anymore because it seems that China is using it to collect people's DNA.
Oh, no, I use Ancestry.com, but I don't do that 24andMe. Hell no.
Okay, so you don't send the, okay, all right.
No. Okay, so I looked it up. Purvis is the 11,117th most popular name of all time. As a last name, Purvis was the 2,177th most popular name in 2010. That's so cool.
Huh.
But see, it originates from Scotland. Now,
really?
I'm not as Irish. I'm not as Irish as I thought I was. And we thought my dad's mom's side of the family was all Irish. Nope, she's not. Or she wasn't. There's some Irish, but it's mostly Scottish. But what I thought was really funny is my roommate, Chris, he's still in the group, but he's back in Virginia. I started doing his family tree for him. I started it, and I'm looking. His last name is Smith, right? Smith. I'm like, oh, my God. And what I found to be really funny is all my ancestors that are from Scotland and Ireland, he has the same exact areas, same places. See, I have Smiths in my family as well, but it cuts off once they leave Ireland and Scotland. I said, dude, if we're related somehow, like 15 generations ago. But yeah, I thought it was pretty cool how all the places that my family's from, his family's from. So I'm sure there's some relation, and it could be like my grandfather was related to his, you know, cousin's mother's brother's father's sister down the road is what I'm saying. You know, I'm saying it like so far off. But all right, let's go ahead. I'm skipping China because and I know I can't pronounce.
Don't worry about it. We'll get.
But the Kowei. Well, I'm gonna do the little blurb. The Kowei dynasty was in China, and Luoyang was the city, And it was from 220 to 265, and that empire lasted about 45 years. Oh, excuse me. And it says, look up the Three Kingdoms for other information. And Cal Pi. Sorry, I had to say it. P-I, by the way. It's Cal. It's C-A-O, Cal, and Pi. And if you don't get the joke, then forget it. Carthaginian Empire is the modern-day Tunisia, and the capital was Carthage. From 814 BC to 146 BC, lasted about 668 years. Best known for the Roman Republic's rival in the Punic Wars, Carthage was a North African commercial hub that flourished for over 600 years. And Ditto was the first ruler. And it doesn't have, I guess he was the only one for the name Ditto. So if you notice in the movie, what the hell is it called? Gladiator. They talk about the Battle of Carthage.
Yes.
So ancient Carthage was a city in modern Tunisia, and also the name given to the city-state and empire it eventually gained. So the settlement was founded by the Phoenicians in the 9th century BC, and the city-state was destroyed by the Romans. Though later they rebuilt the city lavishly. At its height in the 4th century BC, the city-state was one of the largest metropolises in the world, and the center of the Carthaginian Empire, a major power in the ancient world that dominated the western Mediterranean. So Carthage was settled around 814 BC by colonists from Tyre, a leading Phoenician city-state located in present-day Lebanon. In the 7th century BC, following Phoenicia's conquest by the Neo-Assyrian Empire, Carthage became independent, gradually expanding its economic and political hegemony across the western Mediterranean. So by 300 BC, although its vast patchwork of colonies, vassals, and satellite states controlled the largest territory in the region, including the coast of Northwest Africa, southern Iberia, which is Spain, Portugal, and Gibraltar, and the islands of Sicily, Sardinia, Corsica, Malta, and the Balearic Archipelago. Shut up, dog. Mike, he's been outside for an hour, and the little heifer wants to go back out. Among the ancient, you know what? I'm never using Wikipedia again. I swear to God, I keep getting these warnings flashing. You're going to pay for it. Huh?
You say that all the time. You don't like Wikipedia.
Oh, I'm not using it now because now you got to pay for Wikipedia. They're telling me I got to pay for it.
Encyclopedia Britannica?
No, Wikipedia.
No, Encyclopedia Britannica.
No, I could use Encyclopedia Britannica, but I couldn't find shit, so I said never mind. As the dominant power of the Western Mediterranean, Carthage inevitably came into conflict with many neighbors and rivals, from the indigenous Berbers of North Africa to the nascent Roman Republic. Following centuries of conflicts with the Sicilian Greeks, its growing competition with Rome culminated on the Punic Wars from 264 to 146 BC, which saw some of the largest and most sophisticated battles in antiquity. Having narrowly avoided destruction in the Second Punic War, the Romans destroyed Carthage. In 146 BC, after the Third and Final Punic War, later founding a new city in its place, all remnants of Carthaginian civilization came under Roman rule by the first century AD. And Rome subsequently became the dominant Mediterranean power, paving the way for its rise as major empire. Notwithstanding the cosmopolitan character of its empire, Carthage's culture and identity remained rooted in its Phoenician Canaanite heritage, albeit a localized variety known as Punic, or Punic, whatever you want to pronounce it. Like other Phoenician people, its society was urban, commercial, and oriented toward seafaring and trade. So this reflected in part by its more famous innovations, including cereal production. Not cereal like cereal you eat, a different cereal. Uncolored glass, the threshing board, and the coffin harbor. Carthaginians were renowned for their commercial prowess, ambitious explorations, and unique system of government, which combined elements of democracy, oligarchy, and republicanism, including modern examples of checks and balances. Despite having been one of the most influential civilizations of antiquity, Carthage is mostly remembered for its long and bitter conflicts with Rome, which threatened the rise of the Roman Republic and almost changed the course of Western civilization. Due to the destruction of virtually all Carthaginian texts after the Third Punic War, which most of what is known about the civilization comes from Roman and Greek sources, many of whom wrote during or after the Punic Wars, and to varying degrees were shaped by the hostilities. So popular and scholarly attitudes towards Carthage historically reflected the prevailing Greco-Roman view. Though archaeological research since the late 19th century has helped shed more light and nuance on Carthaginian civilization. So I guess it's kind of like how they did back in the day, that if you were somebody, and I think I can try to think of if it was the Asians that did this, where their name was stricken from all history books as if you never existed. So that's what they tried doing, or they did. And so once you were like banned or whatever, that's it. It was like you never existed from memory. The name Carthage is to the early modern Anglicization of Middle French Carthage. This is where it came from, the name Carthage came from. And you know what? It's too blah, 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 blah. It sounds like Charlie Brown's teacher. I'm not even going to read it. Sorry. So this goes into the foundations of the legends of Carthage, settlement as a Tyrian colony. Talks about all the different things that went into. Independence and expansion was from 650 to 264 BC. Then the formation and characteristics of the empire. The conflicts with the Greeks. Unlike the existential conflict of the later Punic Wars with Rome, the conflict with Carthage and the Greeks centered on economic concerns, as each side sought to advance their own commercial interests and influence by controlling trade routes. For centuries, the Phoenician and Greek city-state had embarked on maritime trade and colonization across the Mediterranean. While the Phoenicians were initially dominant, Greek competition increasingly undermined their monopoly. Both sides had begun establishing colonies, trading posts, and commercial relations. In the Western Mediterranean, roughly between the 9th and 8th centuries, Phoenician and Greek settlements had the increased presence of both peoples led to mounting tensions and ultimately open conflict, especially in Sicily. And then there, it goes over the First Sicilian War, the Second Sicilian War, the Third. Damn, they just want to keep fighting. The Pyrrhic War, the Punic Wars. Apparently, they love to fight. The Mercenary War. It was the shortest one. And the Punic Wars. Damn, that was like 20 years. The Third Punic War and the aftermath. Was anything even left after all of that fighting? Following Carthage's destruction, Rome established Africa Salaris as its first province in Africa, which roughly corresponded to the Carthaginian territory. Utica, which had allied itself with Rome during the final war, was granted tax privileges and made the regional capital, subsequently becoming the leading center of Punic trade and culture. In 122 BC, a populous Roman senator founded the short-lived colony of Colonia Luonia, probably because of the stupid name. After the Latin name for the Punic goddess Panic, Luno Celestis, located near the site of Carthage. So its purpose was to provide arable land for impoverished farmers, but it was soon abolished by the Roman Senate to undermine Gracchus's power. Oh, Senator Gracchus. Yeah, so basically everything that a lot of the people in Gladiator, Senator Gracchus. So they're that's true. I'm probably saying not all of it, but some of it is true. Nearly a century after the fall of Carthage, a new Roman Carthage was built on the same site by Julius Caesar between 49 and 44 BC. So it soon became the center of the province of Africa, which was a major breadbasket of the Roman Empire and one of its wealthiest provinces. Okay, I got to stop because this dog has gone full-on retard and will not shut up. I have to go let him out. I apologize. Jesus, the dog is like bouncing
okay.
up and down. I swear to God, from 11 o'clock today until now, he's probably spent 6 hours outside. Little asshole. I'm telling you, I'm doping the dog up tonight because I'm not listening to this friggin' bark at a flea fart and a leaf falling out of the tree. And my bed is not, it's not a firm bed, it's soft. So any movement, shit, I'm like bounced off the bed. So, that's all they do. They jump, they run, they just go and go. They get on my last nerve. I don't think I have any left.
I love them.
So, we'll stop with Carthage and we'll just keep on with it this week. I guess we got 400,000. I'm just kidding. Let me see how many pages of, oh, crap. Hold on. We got, oh, it stopped at the Soviet Empire. But I kid you not, we have, actually, it's the Zulu Empire is the last one. The Zulu Empire of South Africa, Kwabulawayo Ulundi is the capital city of South Africa. But yeah, we got a ways to go because, like I said, a lot of these countries have multiple empires in different places. So, and I skipped, I kid you not, I probably skipped about a lot of the Asian ones because I can't pronounce it and I'm not going to butcher it. So, yeah, a lot of them I've skipped. So my apologies. But anyway, I guess I can stop at that. Oh, the Sika Empire. See, there's only so much I can pronounce without having a brain aneurysm. I'm not kidding. I'm just friggin', you know. Oh, tomorrow, we're going to see how this goes. Tomorrow, I go apply for a job at a chiropractor's office. And,
oh, you got the license?
Huh?
I said you were able to get your license. I know you said you were.
Oh, hell no.
Waiting.
No, no. As a case manager for this chiropractor's office. But the cool thing about it, it's not just a chiropractor's office, though. And so they sent me a, they asked me to apply for this job, and I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. So I got to take a test to see how stupid I am. And I hate the word test. I like quizzes. I have test anxiety, okay? So I said, I sent her an email. I was supposed to go today, but I didn't go to bed until 5 o'clock this morning because they're dumbasses. But anywho, an email back, and I said, you know, before I waste your time and my time, do I have to get the COVID vaccine? Because I can't. I said, per my doctor's advice, I cannot take it. That's not the only reason, because I'm not taking it. And you know what she told me? And I was floored when I read this response. She says, oh, no, we don't believe in the vaccine.
Oh!
You what? No, they don't. They believe in herbal medicine. They believe in alternative and herbal medicine.
You said that she's a that they're a chiropractor. That yeah, most chiropractors are not going to support any too much any vaccine because they're into natural medicine.
Yeah, that's what the whole office is. So they're not only. They're not only chiropractors, but herbalists, but they're whatever. And if I get this job, I'm going to love it because I'm going to learn as much as I can.
What is it called, homeopathic something?
Yeah, homeopathic and herbal and all that cool stuff. So I'm going to learn as much as I can from them. But it's a case manager's job. It's using my degree that I paid $100,000 for. I kid you not, I've applied for 60 jobs under healthcare administration and have been turned down because I'm overqualified because
You're
of my nursing degree.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, because of my nursing.
I know, but if you're willing to take the pay cut, what the fuck should they care? They should benefit.
That would because you're going to demand a raise. Because you could say, well, I made this much money, and it's like, whatever.
But if you thought that way, you wouldn't be applying for the damn job to begin with.
Exactly.
People don't have any brains. You don't want to work for them anyway.
Nope. But, hey, when one door closes, another door opens.
Yep. God
That's the way I look
that.
At it.
Yep.
So, anywho, tomorrow I'm going to continue on. With our survival, survival medicine / shit that you may have to do. I'm going to keep going with that book. I ordered, the link that I wanted you to share that I sent to you, Facebook would not let me share this link, even though I got the product from Facebook. It's a book written by PAs and doctors, and it's called The Home Doctor. So, yeah, hopefully I'll be getting it in the next day or two. But it teaches you everything. If you have
it
to
must be narrative,
huh?
I said it probably goes against the narrative. There's probably something in there against COVID.
Oh, no. Probably. You know what? Probably the way they think, it probably does. So, but anyway, Bobby, I know you probably don't have much time left, so you can go ahead and close out if you want to.
Yeah, definitely. It's we're down to almost 3 minutes.
Yeah, go ahead.
But it was as usual, another great show there, kiddo. Excuse me, kiddo.
Thank you very much.
Yes. And thank you, everybody who participated and those who listened in. Good night and God bless everybody. What's that?
I was going to say, at least I pronounced more shit right tonight. If I stick to what I can pronounce.
Right. But God bless America. God bless our kids, our veterans, our first responders, our troops, and God bless the Defender 7. Good night,
Amen.
Everybody.
Good night.